If you have your Bible, please open to Deuteronomy chapter 5. We are continuing our study here in Deuteronomy. We started several weeks ago, I guess, and we've been pushing our way through. The last couple of weeks I've been on other topics, but now we're back in Deuteronomy. And you may remember that last time that we were in Deuteronomy, we looked at the first four of the Ten Commandments. And many Bible scholars and students have recognized that as you look at the Ten Commandments, the first four pertain mostly to our relationship with God. That is, of course, the foundation of our relationships with other people. And the last six of the Ten Commandments pertain to our relationships with others. And I think that if we would obey the Ten Commandments, I mean, if the Ten Commandments were taught worldwide, what amazing change that would happen in people's lives. Sometimes I wonder, is there some way that we could make people obey the Ten Commandments, make people obey at least the last six of the Ten Commandments? What an amazing transformation that would have upon our world. But, of course, people don't. And one of the reasons that people have so much conflict in their lives and the reason there's so much error and so much sorrow and failure in our world today is that the people don't obey these very obvious and very simple commands. Don't do this. Do this. And so our world is in such a rotten state that it is because of the fact that people don't obey these commandments. And so today we'll look at the final six of these Ten Commandments that really reflect and show us how to have a proper relationship with other people. And you'll notice that commandment number five pertains to our family relationships. And so in verse 16 it says, "Honor your father and your mother, as the Lord your God has commanded you, that your days may be long and it may be well with you in the land which the Lord your God is giving you." Honor your parents. God's plan for the family requires that children obey their parents. Over in Ephesians 6, chapter 2, the Bible says, "Children, obey your parents," basically quoting from this passage. And so we know that it is an obligation for children to not only obey their parents, but honor them as well. And this is an important thing because parental authority is a primary building block in a stable society at large. The larger segments of our society would be benefited from parents having authority over their children and children obeying their parents. Somebody put it this way: "The well-being of a person, people, or nation begins in the home, a home in which the father and mother function together in fulfilling the responsibility to train up their children in the way they should go. Within this context, beliefs and values are transmitted from one generation to the next." And so a well-functioning home begins with this command that the children honor their mother and their father. The word for honor here in this command comes from the Hebrew word meaning heavy or weighty. Kavod is the word, if you've ever heard that one before. It means heavy or weighty, not in the sense of weighing, you know, how many pounds and ounces, but in the sense of being honorable, in the sense of having respect or esteem or value. When you value something, you put a lot of weight on it. It makes a lot of difference for you. What somebody says is weighty, or the word that was thrown around years ago, gravitas. A certain person or a certain command structure has gravitas or weight because we recognize the value of it, the honor of it, the glory of it. And so children ought not to treat the commands of their parents lightly or casually. Have you ever seen children who, when their parents command them to do something, just disregard it? It's as if they didn't listen or didn't hear it. They treat the commands of their parents with lightness or with casualness. They don't see the gravity of their parents' commands. And so that is the responsibility of the children, to treat their parents with honor and respect, to put gravity or to put weight on their commands. And parents must insist that their children do that. You have to insist, you have to teach your children, you have to bring them up so that they recognize and they respect their parents and honor them the way that they should. You cannot allow your children to disregard or disobey your commands. I don't know how many parents I've seen when they command and try to tell and try to cajole that child into obedience, and the child just disregards. Disregard, disregard. And usually children, they know that they can disregard their parents to a certain extent, right? I can disobey, 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 but then when the parent says, "Bradley Grant Anderson," Then you say, oh, okay, now you're serious. Now I better obey, because if I don't, I'm going to get a whipping. But I can disregard and disobey up to that point with no consequences. Well, I think that's a big mistake that a lot of parents make, is not imposing those consequences immediately. You command the child, you demand that he obeys. If he does not obey, you impose consequences right away. Now, obviously, you have to give some grace. You have to give some charity toward the child. But ultimately speaking, you demand that that child treats you with respect. Because if he doesn't treat you with respect, guess who else he's not going to treat with respect? Teachers, authorities, policemen, bosses. The child needs to learn that authority within the home. And if you're not teaching it, he's probably not going to get it from anywhere else. So this is a great responsibility that parents have, to teach their children to honor and obey. And by the way, I would suggest not asking the child. I mean, sometimes you want to ask the child if he wants to do something. Do you want vanilla or chocolate? But when it comes to certain things that you want the child to do, you don't put that in the form of a question. Would you like to eat this food, or would you like to eat something else? Or would you like to go to bed now? Isn't it time for you to go to bed now? Wouldn't you like to go? Would you like to do what I'm asking you to do? When you put it in terms of a question, then the child begins thinking, oh, it's my choice whether I do this or not. And I can't tell you how many times I've heard parents trying to get their kids to do things by asking them if they would please do it. Would you please do this for Daddy? Would you eat your peas for Daddy? Would you go to bed now, please, and put your pajamas on? Please, would you? Well, I don't think that's a right way to do it. If a person is demanding honor and respect, you don't put it in those terms. You tell the child what to do and when to do it and how to do it. Now, obviously, as the child gets older, you're able to be more flexible on those things. But especially with little children, you don't give them that authority to tell you what to do. You are the parent. You tell the child what to do. You demand that that child respect and honor you. And there are consequences if the child fails to respect your commands. Now, as we go on, the second part of verse 16, we have a promise, as it says in Ephesians 6:2, the first commandment with a promise. So here's the promise: that your days may be long, and that it may be well with you in the land which the Lord your God is giving you. So long life. Now, that may be personal life, or maybe personal life, or living in the land, as it says there at the end of the verse. Long life or long days in the land which the Lord is giving you. If you read through the rest of the book of Deuteronomy, there's that constant threat that if they fail to obey, God is going to kick them out of the land. So the promise here is, if you obey, if you're following this command and obeying your parents, treating your parents with honor and respect, then you will live long in the land, and it will be well with you. Now, those of us who have any experience recognize that, usually speaking, generally speaking, life goes better when you have a good relationship with your parents. And that's not only true when you're a young person, that's true when you get older, when you move out of the household and you still have a relationship with your parents. Probably most of us have a relationship or have had a relationship with our parents for many, many years, decades after we leave the home. And eventually, of course, our parents pass away, like mine have done. But it's a good thing to try to retain a good relationship with your parents until they pass off the scene. Some people can't do that. I recognize that. Some people simply don't or can't have a good relationship with their parents. But it's in our own best interest, as it says here, that it may be well with you if you continue to show honor and respect to your parents. Even after you've left home, you know, you've left and cleft, as it were, you leave and cleave, and you started your own home and your own family. Does that mean you have no more responsibility to your parents? No. I think we do retain a responsibility of honor and respect to our parents even after we start our own households. That doesn't necessarily mean that we have to do everything that they would want us to do. We have our own family now, and we can't necessarily allow our parents or parents-in-law to direct every decision that we make. But we certainly treat them with honor and respect. All things being equal, the general rule is that those who respect their parents tend to live longer and more satisfactory lives. And so it's in our own best interest to retain that respect and honor to our parents. Now, of course, the assumption here is that parents are acting honorably. So we want to make it easy for our children to respect and honor us. If we're living a dishonorable lifestyle, then it's pretty hard for Christian children to honor us. So we want to live honorably and make it easy for our children to pay us the honor and respect that they should. But parents must insist that their children treat them honorably, and they should make it easy for their children to do that. Let's go on to commandment number 6. In verse 17, a very simple, straightforward verse. You shall not murder. In the Hebrew, it's actually only two words. It just says not kill. And the word kill there is referring to murder. What he's commanding here is the wrongful taking of innocent human life. He's prohibiting the wrongful taking of innocent human life. The Hebrew word here, I'm told, is never used to describe legal execution or death through military. It's generally used of wrongful death of some kind. What the commandment prohibits is the deliberate, malicious, and unlawful taking of innocent human life. Now, we all know that sometimes taking of life is not murder. Several of us just stood up and said that we participated in the military, and thankfully I never had to kill anybody. I don't know if any of the other veterans have had to do that. But in the middle of a war, especially what we would think of as a just war, a war that has good cause and that is done in the proper way, we might have to, in the military, take the life of an enemy. And of course, in World War II and Korea and before that, World War I and different wars, Christian people have fought and have taken the life of the enemy. And that's not murder. Murder is the taking of an innocent life, the deliberate, malicious, and unlawful taking of innocent life. And in some cases, it is lawful to take someone else's life. Taking of human life is not necessarily murder. Some people deserve to have their life taken. In fact, that goes way back to Genesis chapter 9, verse 6, where it says, if man sheds another man's blood, by man, that man's blood will be shed. In other words, humanity, civilization, has the right and the responsibility to take the life of a murderer. I believe in, and I think the Bible teaches front to back, capital punishment. Now, it's very shameful and very sad that our nation today and many nations around the world do not practice, at least in many places, they do not practice capital punishment. That is the forfeiting of the life of the person who commits murder. I'm not sure what the averages are, but a person can commit murder, cold-blooded murder, and be convicted of it and sit on death row for decades. We hear about people who are put to death eventually, but oftentimes they sit on death row for 20 to 30 years. And granted, they are being punished as they sit there on death row in the prison. But I believe that the justice should be speedy. If a person is convicted with no doubt on a murder charge, and especially if there's good evidence, let's say DNA evidence, to show that that person is guilty, I think that person's life should be forfeit and very quickly. So human life, we know, is precious because God is the author of it and because humans bear the image of their Creator. And so since it is sacred, since it is special, since it is different from other kinds of life, it should be treated with respect and dignity, no matter what a person's physical condition. And so both young and old deserve to be protected from the murderer. Murder is wrong in whatever condition or whatever age or whatever place that human life might be. Now, we believe a application of this would be something like the fact that abortion should not be legal. Sadly, as you probably have seen in the news lately, some of the different states have made abortion more and more available and more common. There are some places in the United States where a woman could get an abortion right up until the point of birth. Maybe that's not very common, but it is legal. And so it's sad. Probably in Wisconsin, that's going to be changing pretty soon, I would guess. But in many places, abortion has become much more common. And now if it's not the medical or the surgical abortion, today, of course, they have chemical abortions where you can just take drugs early on in the pregnancy to cause the abortion. So it's very sad that that is happening today because we know that that child in the womb is human. It's just as human as we are. From the point of conception, everything is there. All it's got to do is grow a little bit, and you've got a fully formed human. So to say that that baby in the womb is not human and is a target of being eradicated and not calling that murder is, I think, ridiculous. I think we ought to be pro-life because of this. Murder is sin. It's wrong. It's morally wrong. And for a person, I think, is absolutely fooling himself or herself to think that that baby in the womb is not a human being. I mean, what else is it? Is it a kangaroo or a bear or what? No, it's human. It's human life. It starts at the point of conception, and it goes all the way to the point of natural death. And I think that we ought to be protecting people from womb to the tomb. We're pro-life because killing an innocent human is wrong. Beyond that, another application of this is 1 John 3:15. We're talking here about murder. But what does the New Testament say? 1 John 3:15, whoever hates his brother is what? A murderer. That's what it says. So I don't think any of us probably would be guilty of murder, although, I mean, physical murder. Given the right circumstances, any one of us might commit murder. You look at some of the biblical characters, and some of them committed murder, but I don't think probably, all things being equal, any of us would be murderers. But whoever hates his brother, it says, is a murderer. So we need to consider that aspect of murder here. Of course, this is talking about physical murder, but to update it to our situation here, we need to make sure that we're not guilty of hatred either. And then the seventh commandment after this one, verse 18, you shall not commit adultery. Adultery is marital infidelity. Adultery is a terrible sin because it violates the trust between a husband and a wife. It breaks the marriage covenant. That's a promise that you made before God, and adultery violates that covenant. Somebody said that adultery is betrayal, an intrusion, a rejection of God's instruction, which have been provided for our good. The adulterer separates what God has joined together and fails to love his neighbor as himself. The prohibition against adultery is absolute. There are no ifs, ands, or buts. There are no exceptions to this rule, no loopholes. The commandment forbids all unchaste thoughts, words, and actions. Any form of extramarital contact of this type, an immoral, intimate contact with somebody not your spouse, is adultery, and it is prohibited. Christians are called to moral purity and should allow no hint of moral uncleanness in their lives. In the Old Testament, well, of course, New Testament too, but in the Old Testament, this was a capital crime. Did you know that the Bible forbids it to the extent that if a person is found guilty of this, this would be something that they would forfeit their life? In fact, when they brought the woman caught in adultery to Jesus, what was their expectation? They should stone her to death. And that was a legitimate expectation from the Old Testament. Because Leviticus 20:10, he that committeth adultery with his neighbor's wife, the adulterer and the adulteress shall surely be put to death. Now one wonders, when they brought the adulteress to Jesus, where was the guy? If they were both caught in the act, where's the guy? Well, we don't know. Maybe there's people say certain things about that. But at least they caught the woman. And, of course, we know how that came out. But the Old Testament specified that this was a capital crime. The seventh commandment protects the institution of marriage. The foundation of all social relationships is that relationship between the man and his wife. We know that marriage is to be monogamous. That's between only two people. Heterosexual. That's between a man and a woman, and lifelong. We say in the vows, till death us do part. Somebody said that society and the church in particular must protect the institution of marriage. Stable family units result from stable marriages. A well-run family contributes to a certain order and integrity to broader social relationships. And we as a church have, and we do, take marriage very seriously, and we take unbiblical divorce very seriously. We have had to put people out of the church because of unbiblical divorce. And that's because we take marriage very seriously. You've made a vow before God, and if you don't have grounds for a biblical divorce, then you should not pursue that divorce. Well, many today deny, ignore, or break this commandment. In our society, in our culture at large, even among evangelical Christians, there are many who deny or break this commandment. Some people reject the whole idea of marriage altogether. There are millions of people just living in sin. They're cohabiting. They're shacking up. For whatever reason, they don't want to be married. They want to move along from whoever they're living with. If perhaps the situation changes and they no longer want to be together, they want to be free just to move along without being restricted by marriage. I came across this statistic. Among adults ages 30 through 39, 26% are living together without the benefit of marriage. 30 to 39-year-olds, a quarter of them are living together without being married. That's a pretty amazing thing. But another incredible statistic here is almost 70% of Americans say that cohabiting is acceptable. Now, they say that 70% of Americans are Christians, and yet they also say here that 70% think it's okay. So there's an overlap there. There are many Christians, evangelical believers, people who claim to be Christians, who say that cohabiting is fine. And there are many churches where they tolerate it. I know that for certain. There are churches that tolerate cohabitation, and they don't do anything regarding church discipline. Well, that is not the proper way that it should be. And many who get married, of course, these days are not monogamous. They are involved in extracurricular activity, and there's no consequences. Adultery today is very common. But Christians should not be like other people. That's one thing that sets us apart. We are not like the other people who engage in this kind of behavior. And again, there is a wider sense here in the Bible, because Jesus said that to look on a woman with lust is committing adultery in your heart. So, of course, the Ten Commandments here are talking primarily about physical behavior. When it says, thou shalt not commit adultery, of course, that's what it's referring to. But Jesus broadened out the application here to say, if you lust after a woman in your heart, that's equal with committing adultery with her. And so we have to recognize that we need to be very careful about that kind of thing. It's easy, especially for men, I think, to commit lust in the heart. And we live in today a very pornographic society. If you have access to the internet, of course, pornography is within a couple of clicks away. If you have any of the social media accounts, just scrolling through social media, you're almost bound to see some of this illegitimate material. And so we need to control ourselves. This is where we don't allow ourselves to commit lust in the heart, because we know it's, morally speaking, it's very much like adultery. And so Christians of all people must abide by this important commandment. Adultery should not even be named among us. That's what Paul says. This kind of behavior should not even be named among Christians. We must intentionally avoid anything that would lead us toward adultery. Think of David out on the top of his house there, looking down at that beautiful woman taking a bath. Well, David should have turned around, and if he wanted some company from females, he had a wife already. In fact, I think at that point he had at least a couple of wives. So there's no need for him to commit adultery with Bathsheba when he already had a woman. So we need to make every effort not to allow ourselves to go down that track. And just recently, even a very highly respected pastor that is known in wide circles of Christianity was found to be guilty. In fact, admitted that he'd had an illegitimate relationship with a woman ongoing for several years. That's absolutely foul behavior, and we need to not only make sure that our spiritual leaders are not involved with that, but each one of us, everybody here, needs to make sure that we don't go down that road toward adultery. Commandment number eight is do not steal. Verse 19, thou shalt not steal. The commandment prohibits robbery or theft, that is, taking another man's property unlawfully. The Hebrew word literally means, it talks about something carried away. And if you've seen some of those videos or news reports recently, that's what people are doing. They're breaking into these stores, grabbing a bunch of stuff and carrying it away. That is theft, whether it happens in a store or whether it happens in a home. When you rob a person, that is illegitimate. It is sinful. It's wrong. People steal in countless ways. Anytime we gain by causing another to lose, that's theft. Whether we take something that doesn't belong to us, however we do it, it's a sin against God and against our neighbor. Theft deserves a serious penalty. The thief, if he's caught, if he's convicted, if he's guilty, he certainly should suffer a penalty because of that. But our legal system is very corrupt and very weak. You probably have heard in the news that California had a proposal that reduced the sentences of those who are guilty of theft. For a person stealing less than $950 worth of value, it was only a misdemeanor. In fact, usually they were not convicted of that. Typically, even if they were arrested, they were let go immediately. And so you had lots and lots of thievery going on because everybody knew that you could steal up to $950 and really not get in trouble. Well, did you know that they just reversed that? In California, they had a proposal, I think it was number 46, that reversed the previous proposal. So now they can be much more stringent and stern with thievery, because I think people were recognizing that people were stealing a whole lot of stuff and weren't facing any consequences. And so we need to recognize that the legal system should punish theft. And not only that, in addition to prohibiting theft, the Eighth Commandment guarantees property rights. If the command is thou shalt not steal, that means that we have the right to own things. Now, you may not be aware of this, but communism and socialism are gaining ground in our world today, and socialism and communism would take away private property rights. That's what communism is taking away private property rights so that really the government owns everything and we don't own anything. So individuals, according to this, have the right to private property. Theft violates property rights and threatens the livelihood of those with material goods. Property rights are fundamental and basic to human flourishing, so we must not steal. And there are lots of different ways that people steal, and we need to be very careful that we're not engaged in theft. And then we have commandment number 9, do not give false testimony, he says in verse 20, you shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. The particular context of this, of course, is the court of law. God prohibits a false testimony against one's neighbor in a legal dispute. What God most specifically condemns in the 9th commandment is a lying witness. Most of us, either we've been in a court of law or we've seen courtroom dramas. And what do they usually do when they swear someone in as a testimony or as a witness? You raise your hand, put your hand in the Bible, I swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, and then what do you say? So help me God, usually. So what is that? So help me God is a oath. You're swearing allegiance to the truth. You're saying, God, do so to me if I am telling a lie. You're swearing to tell the truth that you're not telling a lie. And so false testimony in the legal system would corrupt the legal system because a witness would not be reliable. And we know that some witnesses get up on the stand, they swear to tell the truth, and they still tell a lie. That's common. But we should, of course, as Christians, as those who follow God, those who love God, should not be guilty of a false witness. More broadly speaking, this command prohibits telling any kind of lie. This is the lie in the court of law, what we call perjury. But the more general admonition here is don't tell lies. Don't speak lies. Lies against our neighbors harm them. A false witness damages his neighbor in some way. Falsehoods may seem trivial and harmless, but they're not. Harm usually results from lies, even from little white lies. Let me read you kind of an extended quote that I found very helpful in regard to this. This writer, Philip Graham Ryken, puts it this way. A falsehood can be described as an invention, an equivocation, a falsification, a fabrication, or a prevarication. Dishonesty also comes in all different sizes. There are big lies, the whoppers and the grand deceptions, and there are the little white lies that we tell, the half-truths, the flatteries and the fibs. What we say may be true as far as it goes, but we leave out details that might put us at a disadvantage. Or we might say something that is technically true, yet nevertheless intended to deceive. We overstate our accomplishments, putting ourselves in the best possible light. At the same time, we exaggerate other people's failings, thinking and saying the worst about others. We mislead, misquote, and misinterpret. We twist people's words, taking things out of context. In these and many other ways, we exchange the truth for a lie. And as I was reading through that for the first time, I thought, that is our political system in a nutshell, where people do these very things, mislead, misquote, misinterpret, exaggerate people's failings, thinking and saying the worst. That is exactly what the political advertisements are to a large degree. They take people's words and twist them. They put the worst possible spin on what someone has said. They take things out of context. And so obviously it's easy to do that, especially if we are trying to defend ourselves against an accusation or if we're trying to level a criticism against somebody else. It's easy to not tell the truth about these things. And so the command prohibits us from telling lies, but it also implies that we are telling the truth. And the Bible tells us repeatedly that we should tell the truth. We speak the truth in love, is what the Bible says, but we tell the truth. Sometimes the truth is difficult, but honesty is the best policy. That's not a Bible verse, but certainly is true. We want to be honest. We want to tell the truth and not lie. And then the final commandment, verse 21. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife. You shall not desire your neighbor's house, his field, his male servant, his female servant, his ox, his donkey, or anything that is your neighbor. Thou shalt not covet. Covetousness is the desire for something not rightfully owned. It's an illegitimate yearning to have what someone else has. When we desire something in an overwhelming sense, we crave it, we long to possess something that somebody else has and we can't have, that is covetousness. Now, desire in and of itself, even that term in the New Testament, lust, is simply the word desire. We can desire things, some good things. Some of us, I maybe shouldn't mention it, some of us are hungry right now and we desire to have lunch. Some of us desire pastor to quit talking so they can go off and have some lunch. We desire sleep. Some of us are sleepy. We desire to sleep. Some of us are lonely. We desire to have companionship. Okay, so we have legitimate desires, and we can fulfill those desires in legitimate ways. God has given us ways to fulfill our appetites. But when we desire something, we yearn for something, we long for something that we, for whatever reason, cannot have, and somebody else has that thing, and we feel badly about it, well, that usually is covetousness. Somebody put it this way. Covetousness is that little twinge of disappointment whenever someone else gets what we want. It's how we react when a coworker gets a promotion, when our roommate finds romance and we don't, or when a friend goes where we can only dream of going on vacation. We are always comparing ourselves to others, and frankly, we resent it when we don't get what they have. I think that's a good way of expressing it as well. We resent that other person because they have something that we don't have. That's covetousness. That's not just normal desire to have something. Maybe your neighbor has something and you think, boy, I'd love to have that as well. But you don't think ill of your neighbor. If you're happy that your neighbor is able to get something, you kind of wish that you would have that as well, but you don't have the money or whatever. But you don't think ill of your neighbor because he has it and you don't. I think that's okay. But when we think ill of our neighbor, when we think badly of that other person, when we have a bad opinion of him or her because he or she has something we can't have, then that's covetousness. When others succeed and enjoy things we cannot have, we should rejoice. That's what Romans 12:15 says, rejoice with those who rejoice. So let's say somebody gets what you wanted. You were hoping for that promotion, and your coworker gets that promotion. A neighbor gets a new car or a new house or a new tool or something like that. That's my weakness, I guess, is when I see other people with tools that I'd love to have that I can't have. Boy, that'd be great to have that tool. I try not to think badly of them because they have it. I usually say, can I borrow that tool sometime? So we try not to be covetous about these things. We want to rejoice. Hey, you got a brand new thing. Boy, that's great. I'm glad for you. So don't be covetous. Instead, be content. Jesus warns us. He says, take heed and beware of covetousness. Luke 12:15, for a man's life does not consist in the things that he possesses. As my parents have now passed away and we've gone through their things, boy, their life was a whole lot more than just the things that they possessed. We had how many, 4 or 5 garage sales trying to get rid of their stuff, and by the end of it, we were just throwing it in the dumpster. The stuff that they spent lots of time and money to get, we were throwing it in the dumpster. Well, that's the things that we possess. I mean, we can't take these things with us. So we have to focus not on the things that we have, not on the material things, but on the good things that God gives us that really have true value. The Bible says that in whatsoever state we're in therewith, we should be content. Contentment is really just trust in God. You can be content if you believe that God has providentially arranged the conditions of your life. I have what I have through the providence of God, and if God wanted me to have more, he'd give me more. Maybe I can gain a little bit if I work harder, but ultimately speaking, God has put me where I'm at, so I can be content with what God has given me. God has given you what you need, and you should be satisfied with that. Somebody said, faith believes that God will provide, that he who feeds the birds will feed his children. He who clothes the lilies will clothe his lambs. If we are content with our own, we shall not covet that which is another's. I think that's great. If we're content with what we have, we're not going to covet anybody else's things. If we believe that God has given us what we have, there's no reason to covet what somebody else has. When we consider all the spiritual and physical blessings that God bestows upon us and are sensitive to the needs of others, covetousness will not get a grip on our lives. And so do not covet. The Ten Commandments are a summary of the whole Old Testament law. And Jesus summarized the Ten Commandments when he said, you shall love the Lord your God with your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind. This is the first and great commandment, And the second is like unto it, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. That sort of summarizes the first four commands, love God. The second six commands, love your neighbor as yourself. In other words, the Ten Commandments really can be summarized by two commands, love God and love your neighbor. We obey these commands because we love God. We love God by worshiping him properly and using his name reverently. We love our parents by honoring them and obeying them. We love our spouses by being faithful to them. We love our neighbors by protecting their lives and respecting their property and telling them the truth. The God who gave these commandments is a God of love, who wants us to love him and to share his love with others. Jesus said, "Whoever has my commands and keeps them, he it is who loves me." How do we show our love for Christ? By keeping his commands. We cannot separate God's law from God's love. The Ten Commandments also display the character of God. They reveal his sovereignty, his jealousy, his justice, his holiness, his honorableness, his faithfulness, his providence, his truthfulness, and his love. Well, today we focused on the last six of the Ten Commandments. As you think of those, how well are we doing on those? How are our relationships with others? If we would obey these last six of the Ten Commandments, that would solve an awful lot of interpersonal conflict. And so look at these last six, especially the Ten Commandments, and let it affect your life and relationships. The Ten Commandments express God's will for our lives because they're based on God's character. The law, with all its goodness, springs from the goodness of God. The law is good because God is good, and his goodness penetrates every part of his law. Well, let's have a word of prayer as we conclude.